Welcome to At the Intersection. I'm Marion.
And I'm Brian. And this is a podcast about policy and pop culture and how they intersect.
Yeah. And reparations.
Yeah. It's always about reparations.
Today we have a really special interview. We talked to Janelle Jones, who's an economic analyst at EPI, the Economic Policy Institute.
Yeah. And so it was a really, really awesome, fun conversation. Just a bit of background. Janelle has an MA in applied economics from Illinois State University, and before that she got her BS from Spelman in mathematics. So,
She's bona fide.
She's legit.
Yeah, she was really smart, really passionate, really funny, and it was really great to talk to her. And so we will stop introducing it and let you just listen to it.
Have fun. I kind of want to start off with just like a really intro question. So can you tell me your name or who you are and what you do, and then why do you do it?
Oh, that's a good question. So I'm Janelle Jones. I'm an economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. And within that, I kind of work on two separate things. So one, I work on our program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. And that is where we talk about economic outcomes for people of color. And then my second hat is I work with our EARN network, our Economic Analysis Research Network, and it's a network of state-based think tanks that tries to advocate for progressive economic policies at the state and local level. So I've been doing this, I've been doing this work at EPI for almost 2 years now, but I've been doing this kind of work for almost 10. And so why I do what I do,
I was just saying, wow, that's... Yeah, that's a lot.
I know, I'm very old. I know. It just makes me feel elderly. But you know, sometimes you like have to say things like that, cuz I mean I'm very like young presenting. Yeah. So people are like, "Oh, are you on a field trip and like you're lost at this conference?" And it's like, "No, I'm actually like a participant in this conference. Like this is a space where I have like ideas and thoughts and some expertise."
I'm an adult person.
I'm an adult full person who is like here of my own volition. Like it's fine. So I've been doing this, but like, you know, I mean, as a Black woman in this space, like sometimes you just have to like credential yourself because no one will credential you.
Yeah.
So that's basically how like I introduce myself in general. But why I've been doing this work. So it was kind of like a winding road to get here, which I've talked to Brian about before. But I mean, I think the main reason why I do it is because I want working people to have better economic outcomes. So I want that for all workers, but I specifically want it for my people. Like I specifically want Black working people to finally get the payoff that they deserve, that is equitable, that everyone else around them gets, but that is somehow denied. Somehow something is working against them. And I think what we try to do at EPI and what I try to do in my work is, you know, continually point out that it's not individual behaviors. It's not some like lack of work ethic. It's not, you know, not reaching for the right bootstrap. You know, it's none of those things. It's systemic and it's institutional and it's, you know, generations old. So I think that is why I do the work that I do, because I continually want to point that out and I want to advocate for ways to make the working lives of Black people better.
So, okay, I wanted to ease into some of the more deep questions, but I think, can I just like dive in?
Yeah, no, you are running this. You can do whatever you want. And then if it's terrible, I'll just like hang up.
Like, you know what? This interview's over. I can't do this.
So I guess a couple of things. Like one, you talked about how, like what you were saying makes me think about a little bit about kind of Moynihan. This idea about behavior being a solution. It also, I mean, at this time, you know, you guys wrote, at EPI, you wrote the piece kind of responding to the Kerner Report. At the same time, it was around, it's, you know, this year is the 50-year, not anniversary, the 50-year, it's been 50 years since Dr. King was killed. Kind of thinking about like all of those things together makes me think about one, this idea of, you know, behavior and culture of poverty and how it's been perpetuated and continues to be used. And then also kind of like the co-opt of King's messaging away from kind of radicalism and towards like this behavior type of thing. Like, mm-hmm. we need to work on ourselves. And so can you talk maybe about, like, as an advocate and as an analyst, you know, why is it important that we think about systems as opposed to individual behaviors? And kind of how does that play a role in fighting for economic equity?
That is a great question. I mean, I really like want to think about that question every time I do anything. And I think, you know, for generations, like, so I work, you know, I work on economics, but also like within the realm of policy. And I think, you know, generations of policy have been about really trying to like police and control the behaviors of Black people, like just trying to, you know, force them into certain choices, make sure they do this, make sure they do that. And I think what we're seeing now is like, when Black people follow those rules, like, one, that's ridiculous. Like, why are Black people the only people that need these rules? Like, that's trash. So that's already trash. But when Black people still do all of those things, right? Like, when they go to a good high school, and then they go to a good college, and then they major in math, and they get like a doctorate degree, like, guess what? They're still paid less than the white person who did all those things. So I think so much of what we're trying to do is talk about, you know, I think, you know, there's like two competing things. So there's one is like, well, Black people just aren't making the right choices. I mean, that is a trash premise, but let's say, okay, but when they do make the right choices, they're also not getting the payoff. So I think, you know, when we see these kind of disparities and like you control for everything, right? Like you control for occupation and location and all these other things. And the only thing you can't come from is racism. So I think try to talk about ways to close some of these gaps, to make things more equitable, it's impossible to talk about behaviors. Like, it's impossible for that to be the solution. And you talked a little bit about the Kerner report that we just put out. And it was basically saying, you know, in 50 years, like, what has actually changed? Like, we know what Black people have done, right? Like, they've saved, they've gone to school, they've done all the things that you tell them they should do. And a generation later, that payoff is not there. So when we talk about, like, radical transformation, when we talk about, like, big, bold policies, we have to look at systems and institutions, because it's the only way we're going to see change. Because this, like, you know, this policy agenda that we've had for so long has not really gotten us to where we want to be.
So, I mean, just speaking about structures as opposed to behaviors, what is one policy that you advocate for or that you believe in that you think would bring us closer to actually being equitable as a society?
I mean, I am at work, and I probably shouldn't say it, but I'm really just going to say reparations. Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to say reparations.
We were going to ask because you about reparations. Just,
I mean, the reparations question later.
I mean, I really try not to, because, like, EPI doesn't really have a stance. Like, we don't advocate for it in our work. But also, like, I'm a person, and I personally advocate for reparations, because I think so much of what we see is, like, I mean, so much of what informs debate is, one, like, everyone starts from the same place.
Right.
And that is so false. Like, there's never been anything as false as that Black and white people start from the same place. This amazing report that Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton just put out on the racial wealth gap, I mean, it just breaks down myth by myth all of the ways people do not start from the same place. So I think that is, I mean, that's like the one big thing that could really make things more equitable. Because wealth, I mean, it's so much more than just like having money, right? It's like security, it's a health insurance, it's a car insurance, it's an education, like it's all of these things that you need that Black people just don't have. And there are reasons. There are some real reasons for that.
So, not to put you too much on the spot, but how do you want your reparations paid out?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I want, so the thing we have actually been talking about at EPI is how are we going to do this? So I think the idea of just like giving Black people trillions of dollars, I mean, I love that. I love that idea. I'm actually very much for that, but that's going to be tricky, right? Like, that's going to be some tricky business. But I think that that's one way. But there's also like other ways you can give reparations. Like, you can give reparations for mass incarceration, right? Like, that is a thing that you can repair for that. Like, you can pay people back for taking hundreds and thousands of Black men from their communities, from their families, putting them back out into the world without prospects, like you can repair that. Like there's been reparations actually for housing based on, you know, past segregation. Like the government would buy houses and then sell them back to Black families at lower costs. So there are ways that we can do that. But I just want money. Money would be great. Like, I think that would just be fantastic. But there are other ways to do it.
So maybe like taking a step back.
Sure.
Because I think we've been using the word equity. Can you maybe talk about like, what does that actually mean? I guess either from kind of an economics perspective, what does equity actually mean? Or from a public policy perspective. But I think that's a word that gets thrown around, that gets attached to a lot of policies, whether or not they're equitable or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to talk about equity. Like in terms of the economic sense, you know, we mean it like there are no gaps. There are no gaps between like people doing the same thing. Like that's how we talk about like equity and economic outcomes. Like if two people have the exact same job, they should get paid the exact same amount of money. So, you know, when the Black woman is earning 63 cents of what the white man is earning, that is inequitable. So kind of closing racial gaps is one way that we can talk about equity. But I think in terms of public policy, you know, I think the Policy League folks have done a good job of talking about how we include equity at every step. So is it being designed by more than one type of person? You know, when we talk about like how a program is going to be implemented, how a policy is actually going to take place on the ground, like are we talking about who's distributing that program, like who's distributing that service? And then at the end, are we talking about like who is actually going to reap the benefits of that? So I think, you know, the example that people talk about all the time is affirmative action, right? So people think affirmative action is something that just like does wonders for Black people. And I think, you know, it's good, but who are like the real beneficiaries of affirmative action? It's white women. Yep. Like it's actually white women. They benefit more from that. So that's an example of like a great idea, but when you don't actually think about how it plays out, who's going to be really impacted, who has like the access and the opportunity to take advantage of a policy, then you have to think about equity.
So what do you think is the biggest obstacle right now to us reaching equity or at least enacting any sort of equitable policies?
I mean, can I say racism? Can it just be racism? Is that a good enough answer?
That's a great answer.
this interview.
We've
answered all the questions.
I mean, it's like, I know people hate, like they hate that answer. Like they want it to be something else, but I mean, most of the time it really just is racism.
Yeah.
Like it really, truly, honest, like it's not economic anxiety. It's not manufacturing jobs leaving. Like most of the time it is really racism. This idea that like, I mean, the idea about something being unequal, right? It's like, we're trying to shrink the gaps. We're trying to make people stand on a solid footing. And if you are the person that has better footing, like you don't want people, like people being on your same footing is, feels like you're getting something taken away from you.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think this idea that like, you know, this idea that white people have some privilege that they can't live without. I'm not making a lot of sense because it's just racism. Like, I mean, I don't even really know how to talk about it.
No, I think that's really helpful to actually say the word racism, because I mean, there was I think it was New York Times article that I saw yesterday, which I did not click on.
Nope.
It said new study, emphasis on new study, finds that class anxiety or status anxiety rather than economic anxiety led to the election of Trump. And I was like, I think you're saying racism.
And it's crazy, right? Like I work in a place that is incredibly progressive. Like it is very progressive. We have very, very nice white people who work here. They care about justice. They care about people of color, but you know, they don't often say racism. Like it's hard for people to just say the word racism. And it's like, well, it makes me feel bad. I don't know how to fix it. I don't know what to do. And it's like, but okay, it's going to be challenging, but let's start from a real place. Because when we're starting from like your economic anxiety, no, like, I mean, I don't even know where to go from there because that's not even real. And I definitely saw this New York Times article and I was like, not today, Satan. I'm actually not going to click that because I already like, not today, Satan. I don't want any of that in my, I don't want any of that in my day. Like we're really going to try, you know, like I think we're moving so slowly towards saying racism, but we're really going to give racist white people every opportunity to not be racist. Like we're going to talk them into feeling some other way about everything else before we're like, wait, this is just racist. That's really what this is. And I think, I mean, you know, reparations is like a big thing, but you know, like the talk of the DC town right now is this new jobs guarantee proposal that Sandy and Derek have worked on. And one of the things that comes up all the time is like, how are we going to not stigmatize this? Like, how are we going to have it so that Black people and white people can get government jobs, but it doesn't become terrible because Black people are going to do it? Like, it's a huge conversation we're trying to have around narrative, which is like, we want something universal. We want something that's going to be guaranteed to everyone. So how do we not make it terrible when Black people take advantage of it? And it's like, what are we doing? Like, what narrative is that? Like, how are we even here? Where something being universal, because Black people will take advantage of it because they face discrimination in the private sector, now we have to come up with a strategy to not make white people think it's awful. And it's like, that's trash and it's racist.
Yeah. It is. And it does sort of, it forces you to adopt that racist narrative because you think like, well, I have to work around this. And so that means that you're accommodating it basically and preserving white supremacy even as you're trying to enact equitable policies.
Yeah, and I mean, I think John Schmidt has often told me this, and he's like, you know, if a program is somehow going to benefit people of color, like if white people think the majority of people who will take advantage of that program are going to be people of color, then that program is underfunded and it's always under attack. And we look at like, I mean, obviously there are more white people who use food stamps than Black people, like, but you know, people just ignore that fact, but it's always under attack, it's always being cut. And I think, you know, before we even got a pilot program up and running, we're like, how can we like assure white people that this is for them? How can we make them feel special in this thing that is universal? Like it's literally for everyone who wants it.
And that's already the problem. Like the problem with universal policies is that they often don't help people of color. If they're not targeted to people of color, then they're just not going to predominantly help us. And so we're already not specifically helping people of color with this jobs guarantee, like if it's going to be universal, and then we have to even still like further accommodate a white supremacist narrative by saying, well, don't worry, it's mostly going to be white people, or don't imagine a Black person getting this.
Right. I mean, what world is that where like the only way something is politically viable is if we can promise it's only for white people? Right. Like, what world is that? Why is that a thing? But it is so real. It is just incredibly real and depressing and terrible.
Can you talk about people of color and specifically Black people in progressive places or progressive spaces? You know, why I would say it's difficult to get more people of color and more Black people in progressive public policy spaces. And why is that a thing, and what needs to happen? And it's not so much what do we need to do, but what do progressive organizations need to do better in order to get more people of color, not just in the door, but like in leadership and leading these organizations?
That is a great question. Yeah, I often think like if your organization is progressive, but it is majority white, then it's not progressive. Yeah. Like that's like you can't be progressive and also be majority white. Those two things are in contradiction and they're ridiculous. I mean, I think it's hard. I mean, I'm going to talk specifically about like the world I know, which is like the DC think tank. And I think, you know, working from the top down, it's hard to get people of color in leadership in these organizations because there's like a mentality that like, I don't know you. Like if you haven't worked in the think tank world, like I don't know where you stand. So it's hard for people to move up. But it's also hard to get people in the door because, you know, like a lot of hiring, it's done by word of mouth. It's done by networks. So when you have the, you know, leadership of these organizations, it's almost entirely all white. Their networks are white. You know, like their golf buddy's son who's at Cornell does an internship and then he does an RA-ship and then he's a policy analyst and then he's vice president. Like that's how it happens. But I think, you know, it's really at the fault of the organizations, because it just makes everything better. Like, it just makes it better to have people of color in these roles across the spectrum. So I know, you know, I worked at the Center for Economic and Policy Research for a couple of years, and they do, you know, a very intentional, good job of bringing in RAs, training them really well, but it's so hard to get that. And I think when those opportunities aren't given to people of color, like, it's hard to move up. So I think one of the things that has kind of been a benefit for me is that, you know, just like some random white nice man was like, hey, let's make this place less white. Like, let's do that. And I think because leadership is like, you know, it feels like it's huge. Like, it feels like it's a huge thing to do, but it's not, right? Like, if you're a manager, hire a person of color. Like, literally, that's all. I mean, I have people asking me, like, well, how do we do this? Like, how do we become more diverse? Like, what should we be doing? Don't hire any more white people. Full stop. That's what it is. But it's important because it informs everything. You know, I don't think everyone listens to everything EPI has to say, but I think that we have a job in shaping the narrative and, you know, helping people think about economics. And I think when you do that from an entirely white point of view, you're losing it. Like, you're losing the progressive message, and it's not going to resonate with certain groups of people, and those people are not white.
Right.
Is that a good answer?
That was a great answer.
I wanted to say anything else.
I'm going to type it up and CC it to all the white progressives that I know.
Just with a shrugging
emoji. It's just, emoji. I don't... the hands up emoji.
It's like, do better. I don't know what to tell you.
Just do a little bit better. Just do a little bit better. And I think, I mean, just like to talk about this a little bit more, but then the thing is like, hey, you're not white. Can you bring some not white people over?
Right.
And it's just, it's like, I mean, I can, but I also don't want to bring people into an organization where they will be the only non-white person. Yeah. So it's like, you know, the other thing that happens is they will hire a non-white person and they're like, we've done diversity. And then they wonder why they can't keep anyone for more than 18 months. Who wants that? Like, I don't want to be the only person of color in an organization that's supposed to be talking about progressive values. Like, I don't want that. So I think that also plays into it hard being to move up, because it's hard to keep people if, you know, you are the only person that looks like you, like, month after month, research meeting after research meeting, communications meeting, like, messaging meetings, like, all of these things where you are the voice for an entire people by yourself. No one wants to do that in an organization forever alone.
Yeah. And especially, I think, if you don't see leadership of color, so you think, well, there's no way forward for me because I'll be here for a while, but, you know, there's no black leadership, there's no brown leadership, and so there's nowhere for me to go from here.
Yeah, that, I mean, representation matters, as Black Panther has shown us.
I think also, like, from a very practical perspective, so there was a recent episode of Blackish where Junior was at Hampton, Howard, oh God, I didn't,
whoa.
First of all, I didn't go to,
start,
I whoa,
to,
I went start to, I went to over. North Carolina Central University, so I don't really care.
Please start the sentence over, I don't need to get
if you're,
blamed.
I don't care, HU. So anyway, Junior went to Hampton. And Howard, whatever. Wow. And okay, let me, I'm trying to get through this. He can't do it.
He can't do it.
Every time.
He went to HU.
Yep.
Interpret that to be whatever you wanted to be. And no, but there was a moment where he saw, he said, I've never seen black people on both sides of the picket line, like arguing against each other.
Oh, I remember
and so
that.
I think like there's a very real thing about there being, like if you have one or two black people at your organization, you know, they're thinking the entire time like, all right, am I representing myself? Who am I representing?
Yeah.
I don't want to publicly disagree with the only other black person. Right. And so there's not enough space to like actually have a rich conversation and to like get some value out of that. And so I think, you know, that's true when you don't have, we only have one person of color in leadership. And I mean, it's a stressful situation.
Yeah, my dad was actually asking me the other day. He was like, so what is it like? Because I work for a majority black organization now. This is for the first time in my life. He said, what is it like?
Oh, right.
Like, what is that like? And I said, so what's weird is that like I'm not since I'm no longer the only Black woman, I feel like I'm not the angry Black woman. Like, I'm just Marion, your coworker. And so, like, mm-hmm. I have a lot more, like, people know a lot more about my personality than I'm just angry all the time. A, because I'm not, you know, railing about how we need more race equity. And B, because, like,
right.
yeah, like, they can see me in all of my different dimensions because I'm not there representing an entire race.
And, like, don't we want that? Like, don't people want that from their employees? Don't they want people to be their full human selves? Right. I mean, there's not that many Black people on our research team. Like, it's just me and Valerie. But, you know, me and Valerie are actually very different. Right. Like, we have different opinions about all sorts of things. And when you have more than one, you get to do that. I remember someone saying, like, I want enough Black people at my organization where I don't have to like all of them. Like, I want to have enough people there where I can be mad at one and, like, still have another one. Like, isn't that a threshold we all want? Like, I want to have so many Black people that we're actually not all friends. Can you imagine?
Right.
Oh, that's wild.
So,
it is wild.
Speaking of, like, kind of on this realm, can you tell us kind of what you do to take care of yourself?
Self-care is so crucial. No, that's important. I don't know. I feel like I don't really do that well.
That was something I'm
But let me on. Think of let me think of a real answer. Mm-hmm. I know, like, that is hard. But, like, what are the things that I'm doing to take care of myself? So I think one thing that I've actually started doing kind of recently is within, like, the think tank community in DC, just, like, having a cohort of non-white people mm-hmm. that get what I'm going through and just, like, being very close with them. So I have, like, a Black woman at CAP and a Black woman at Equitable Growth. There's a Black woman who used to work at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. There's a Black woman at Third Way. And, you know, like, once every couple of weeks, we just get together and talk about the crazy things white people did over the past couple of weeks. Like, you know, and it seems like, oh, it's just like Black women made me angry. But it's also just this feeling of, like, this is a real thing, right? Like, this is not me thinking everything is a microaggression. This isn't just, like, my organization not living up to the dream. But when you hear, like, oh, no, 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 sis, that happens. No, 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 that happened to me, like, 2 hours ago. So right. I think that helps because I think you can start to feel so isolated. And, like, already the work is hard, right? Like, the work is already hard. But then when you add in this other dimension of race, it becomes just exhausting. So I think having a group of people who you can vent to who gets it is something that I have found to be, like, irreplaceable. I really do. And I think, you know, the other thing I do that, you know, because EPI is actually, like, a very fantastic place to work is sometimes I really do just, like, take a sick day and call in Black. So after the election, no, I mean, I really, so after the election, there was, like, an all staff meeting the next day. And I emailed my supervisor and I said, you know what? I think that that's great. I think you guys should talk about that, but I don't want to see any white people today. So I'm going to take a sick day and I'm just not going to come in. And he was like, yeah, that makes sense. You should do that. That makes sense for you. So sometimes I will do that, you know, right? Like, after seeing, like, another Black woman violated in a public place on Twitter, sometimes I'm like, I have to go. I have to take a sick day. I'm just going to go home, and I'm just not going to think about this anymore. And, you know, it's hard, right? Because there's, like, so many things happening every day that are trash. Like, every second something trash happens. But I think sometimes, you know, as selfish as it can seem, I just can't read, like, the story of another hashtag. Like, I just can't look at Black women being treated terribly all of the time. So sometimes I just have to, like, block that out, find a happy place. I mean, I go home to Ohio more often than I should probably. So spending time with my family is something I do. I probably go home to Ohio every 3 weeks, even though I live in DC, right? So it's not like I live, like, 2 hours away. Like, it's very far, but it resets me. It reminds me of why I'm doing the work. It makes me feel good. It helps me, like, block out politics. So that's something that I do. I mean, I've consistently done that as long as I've worked in DC. Like, I go home all of the time. So I think those are probably the three things, like having my cohort of Black people, taking time completely out of the office when I need it, and then, like, going home to see my family often.
Yeah.
That's real. That's good.
I know Melissa Harris Perry talks about squad care versus self-care, and that, like, you can't just take care of yourself all the time. Like, you need your people to help you take care of you. and you need to help
take. Oh, care. I love Claude Care.
Yeah,
and I think we're all like doing it for each other. Like I really think it helps. Like it helps to for you to talk about it. It helps for you to hear about it. It helps for you to just like have a happy hour about it. Like it all just helps to not be doing it alone because it can feel that way.
Yeah, for sure. I guess my last question would be, we talked about what you think our biggest obstacle is, but what are you most hopeful about? Either about anything that we've talked about.
Hopeful, Marion?
Yeah, hopeful. There's some hope there.
Hopeful? Yes. Have you met any economists? We're not hopeful. We don't have any hope. Like, what are the most famous, like, have you met any people? Like, the most economic, like, most famous economic saying is, like, in the long run, we're all dead. That's, yeah. Like, what economics is known for. What am I hopeful for? I know, right? What am I hopeful for? I do get this question. I feel like I never have a good answer. What am I hopeful about? So I think there's probably two things. So one, I'm like incredibly excited about young people. Like I remember being 18 and like, I'm sure terrible things were happening all the time, but I was not in the streets. Like I was not protesting. Like I was not doing any of that. So I am like very hopeful that young people of color will just like take the lead, push all of these old terrible people out of the way and make a better world. I have like a lot of hope in young people. And I mean, the thing that I always have hope in is just Black women. Cause I feel like things can only get so bad before Black women are just like, fine, we will fix it. Like we will do this. And I think that we are seeing, you know, I think we're seeing now people, I mean, people never completely listen to Black women, but I think maybe sometimes a little bit, they're starting to listen. And so I'm hopeful that that will continue and not get derailed and people won't get distracted from it and that they'll really continue to listen to Black women as they consistently show up for this entire nation all of the time. So I think those are probably my two constant hopes. But, you know, on average, I think everything is mostly trash.
That's fine.
So I don't want to end on an optimistic. I mean, and also like Beyonce, right?
Okay.
Like it's really a miracle that we are alive in a time to see Beyonce at her prime. Like, can you imagine, like think about all the people who have lived who have not seen Beyonce. So I'm like very hopeful about that. Very excited about that.
So hopeful about Black women in general and in particular, Beyonce.
Like Black women in general, and then specifically Beyonce.
Putting us all on her back.
Well, if anyone can do it, it's Beyonce. There's nothing she can't do.
I mean, she essentially opened up another HBCU.
Yeah, that's true.
In charge.
Like,
of white
people. Did you see the merchandise? Like, it's a real thing.
She was like, Black Twitter, like, free for y'all.
It was glorious. It was the best thing I've ever seen.
No, it was magnificent. It was.
It really was.
Let me not go off on a rant about Beachell.
I know. Let me not talk for another 30 minutes while I just talk to you every second through that performance at Coachella. Like, let me just not do that for the next 30 minutes.
We open. It's like, let's stop.
There's a crown. She taps a cane. Oh, it was glorious. But no, it was good.
It was fine. It was okay.
We really appreciate the time and the insight.
Sure.
I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I don't have any insight. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what anyone's doing.
I think.
Thanks, guys.
I'm not going to say I feel happier, but I do feel like more prepared.
Yeah, I never feel happier talking to an economist, but definitely more prepared.
No. And like truly every time anyone here has a media call, it's like, oh, how'd that call go? And they're like, they weren't optimistic, but they were informed. And it's like, done. That's really what we're doing. I mean, the EPI logo could be like, you won't feel better, but you'll know the facts. That's really what it is. Like, we're not here to brighten up your day, just to let you know exactly what you should be upset about today. That's mostly it. But I'm glad to, you know, do what I can. You guys are great.
Fantastic conversation with the fantastic Janelle Jones.
Yeah. So, you know, that was a lot of fun. and hopefully we'll be able to have more conversations like that. I think that was, I learned a ton, so.
Yeah, and I think we were joking about this, but you never feel more optimistic after you talk to an economist, but no. Definitely better informed.
Yeah, for sure.
Better prepared for the world.
So, Marion, what are you reading?
So, I guess on the theme of Beyonce and Coachella and how she changed everyone's world and life and the meaning of everything, one article I really enjoyed, surprisingly from the New York Times, was Beyonce and the End of Respectability Politics, and it's just about her Coachella performance and the undeniable blackness of it all. And just this one quote, "All black people should follow her lead and refuse to shrink blackness," which I think is just, it's a great message to take from a great performance. And yeah, the whole op-ed is fantastic. And so it'll be linked.
Can we talk just a brief second? I know this is not the section to talk more about stuff.
Okay.
But is that okay?
No, please.
So, you know, one thing, first of all, I woke up the next morning and Brianna was holding Zion watching the performance mm-hmm. on the phone, and he was just looking at it. I'm like, this is perfect. And he was so content. And no, but I think, you know, the one reason why I really appreciated it so much is because, you know, when you go to an HBCU, and I don't want to say this is everybody's experience, but I know this was my experience, and I know it was shared by a lot of people. You make a decision. You're like, I'm going to go to this school because it has the things that I need. Mm-hmm. I need this environment. At least for me, it was like, I needed this environment. I need to be in a place where I'm not the only black person, where I can actually figure out who I am outside of Brian as a black person, like who is just Brian.
Yeah.
I want to be in a place where I see black people across a political spectrum, across a socioeconomic spectrum, black people arguing, mm-hmm. And it not being based upon them being black, but just upon who they are as individuals.
Them just being people.
But so those are all the wonderful things that come with going to HBCU. But then the difficult part is you constantly having to justify that the school that you attended is a legitimate school,
right.
In all sorts of realms. I remember when I first was going, before I even left to go to school, I told somebody at like my old boss at my part time that I was working, and he was like making fun of the name of the university. In retrospect,
fun of Central?
Yeah, in North Carolina Central University. But yes, and so,
okay.
You know, that business closed. So you know, joke's on you.
Who's laughing now?
but yeah, like to see her, and she didn't even go to a HBCU, but like that culture does belong to her as well. And so to see her. Embrace that, embrace the Black Greek life culture,
mm-hmm.
the band culture, and to do it in a way that, you know, there wasn't an explanation, there wasn't any attempt to bring everybody else in. This is for black folk.
Right.
Period.
Right.
And everybody else, welcome to the show.
Right. And the fact that she, you know, she decided, you know, I know that the majority of this audience is going to be white, and that's just sort of how Coachella is, but I'm not going to change myself. I'm not going to change what's important to me to adapt to their own culture. Like, I'm going to bring my culture, and they will be there. They've paid to be there, and they can experience it.
Right.
Yeah. I did not go to an HBCU, but I am obsessed with marching bands, and so that was something I have in common with Beyonce, which is, you know, it's a really long list of things I have in common with her. Yeah, so that's one thing that I'm reading. And there's also, since we talked about reparations a lot with Janelle, I think The Case for Reparations, Ta-Nehisi Coates, which, you know, the article itself is, it's not even an article, just the piece itself is 4 years long, but 4 years old.
It's about 4 years long. Too.
It's roughly 4 years. I'm still reading it. Is why. but yeah, it's just an incredible examination of American history and self-image and how it's impossible for us, if we're being honest about what America is, to separate America from racism and white supremacy, and how until we actually are honest as a society about how we've been built, then there's no way for us to really move forward. So yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
Yeah. I guess what I'll recommend is a piece written by Janelle and two of her coworkers. It's from EPI called 50 Years After the Kerner Commission. African Americans are better off in many ways, but still disadvantaged by racial inequality. So it's a piece that looks back on kind of what progress has been made over the last 50 years. And so it's a good piece that acknowledges like that there has been some movement made, but also calls out the fact that we haven't made the structural policy changes that we need in order to actually see important strides towards equity. Strides.
There it is.
Yeah.
We are striving to make strides.
We ain't there yet, is what the article actually says.
That's the whole article. We ain't there yet.
In caps. Bold.
So those are good. Those are good recommendations.
Yeah.
So you can follow us on Twitter. We are at the podcast. You can find us on our website at the-intersection.com. You can subscribe on iTunes and Apple Podcast. Subscribe on Stitcher. We're on Anchor. We're on Pocket Cast. Mm-hmm. We are still not on SoundCloud.
And please leave a comment. We really appreciate people
Leaving
comments and ratings and stuff like that.
Yeah, rate us, review us, subscribe. That actually makes a huge difference. Just gets us out there to more people other than our loved ones.
Yeah.
And shout out to DJ Seven Keys, who produced our music. You can find him on Instagram and Twitter at Mr_7Keys.
Awesome. Well, this was At the Intersection, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Thank you.